Hello, 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 and welcome to My Empty Hands, a podcast about the martial arts with a focus on Kenpo. As always, I am Reggie Darden, and I'm excited to have another great guest with me today, Mr. Gary Wilson, and we are going to talk some Kenpo, talk some martial arts, talk about his journey in the martial arts and in Kenpo, and whatever other items that we want to talk about, we're going to get into that as well. I'm really excited because he's in from my old stopping grounds in Southern California. And so I'm going to get to kind of relive some of those good old days in Southern California. So excited about that. And but yeah, we'll, I usually kind of go through and kind of go through my background, but we're here for the guests, so I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Wilson here and just go ahead and fill me in on how Kenpo found you, how the martial arts found you, and where did it all start for you, and we'll kind of go from there, and I'll throw in my little tidbits as needed. So yeah, take it away.
All right. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. Appreciate that. I always like to talk Kenpo. I started it's funny, going back as a kid, I was born in California and my parents moved back to Michigan where they were from, South Lansing, which was a really rough neighborhood. So growing up, needless to say, I fought going to school and I fought coming home from school, little kind of gangbanger things, you know, but it's more neighborhood kids, and my cousins lived across the street. So I had my cousins, my brother and me, he's my older brother, and then a couple of the kids down the street. So we all stuck together, and every day was fighting going to school, fighting coming home from school. And that's where I learned that I really enjoyed fighting, and that was my thing back then. I liked hitting and I liked getting hit, so they both worked for me. And then we moved to California, back to California in 69, and mid-year, so me and my brother both had to kind of fight our way through school once again because we were the new kid on the block and everybody was testing us, and they found out that we fight a little bit better for Michigan than what they were fighting at the time because we were used to it, you know. So I always liked the martial arts, watching Bruce Lee and Chuck Norris and, you know, all those guys. So that was my big interest. It was really something that I wanted to do. And my parents, I don't know how old I was, but I was pretty young. Me and my brother both, my dad knew a guy that was working with him that was, I think, training to be a cop, and he was taking Taekwondo lessons out of a guy's garage. I don't know what belt rank he was or anything, but we went over there and we checked it out and we both liked it. And I remember it was $35 a month for each one of us, and my parents could afford one but not both, so if we both couldn't do it, neither one got to do it. So later in life, when I think I was around 22, 23, January 1986, whatever I was back then, married, and I was bored. I didn't have any kids at the time, and I had the money then, and I was bored, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to take karate. You know, I've always wanted to do that. So I looked up in the Yellow Pages, started flipping through it, and here in Lemon Grove, San Diego, California, Lemon Grove is where I lived, and there was a karate school right in the middle of town that said Ed Parker's Kenpo Karate, which, unfortunately, at the time, I'm thinking, Ed Parker's Kenpo Karate? I'm thinking it should be some kind of Oriental name, you know, some Chinese or Japanese name. So I'm thinking, I don't know if I really want to take karate from some guy named Ed Parker, you know. So I thought, what the heck, it's close. It's like a mile away. And so I called up and made an appointment. They did 5 introductory lessons at the time, and I think that's what Parker was doing too. I went down there and didn't really know who Ed Parker was or anything else. I got lucky, so ended up being the right choice. I took the introductory lesson, had a blast, went back for the second one, the third one, and, you know, the fifth one, that was the hook, you know, hook, line, and sinker. They got me because it was in my blood. I was like, I love this stuff. So, and the one instructor, Stephen Hage, that was teaching me on the, I think it was the second lesson, he taught me Lone Komodo. He goes, hey, I'm going to teach you, you're doing so good. You know, I'm sure that was just a thing to plea to, you know, hey, make you feel good. So I'm going to teach you an orange belt technique. So he taught me Lone Komodo, and I went home bragging it up. I said, yeah, I'm so good. I got this orange belt technique, you know, and I was pumped. And so went back on the fifth lesson, signed up for lessons, started training. And at Purple Belt, the instructor there at the school, my instructor, Mr. Darby Darrow, best instructor I've ever had. Awesome, awesome instructor. He was becoming a San Diego police officer at the time. And there's nothing that guy couldn't do. He trained from the Gracies for a while. And Helsing Gracie said, you know, he goes, I teach this guy something one time and he's got it. You know, I had to work a little bit harder at it. But once I got to Purple Belt, Mr. Darrow really liked what I was doing. So he had me start teaching classes. And that was it. You know, I was down there every single day of the week. I was down there when the school opened. I was there when it closed. And if he was there on a Sunday, which sometimes he was, because he'd bring the cops in once things got going and they would do different drills and stuff, I'd jump in with that and work with them. And so it was at right around Purple Blue. He also said he wanted to start teaching me private lessons. So I was the only one that I know of that he was giving private lessons to at the time. So every Wednesday I was invited to the advanced class, and every Wednesday he'd give me an hour private, and then we'd go into the advanced class from there. And he was just phenomenal as an instructor. All the instructors I've had over the years have been great instructors, but he was just a guy that could really teach you, you know, how to move, how to do it. Any problems you had, he'd find out, you know, he'd tell you this, do that, and just make things work. And it was funny, I think I was getting ready to test for my brown belt. Video tapes started coming out, and everybody had these video recorders that took the whole VHS tape. So he got one and he said, everybody bring down a VHS tape. So I did, and he filmed me, and he was having me do upward blocks. And it's funny because I'm doing the upward blocks, and he's having me, as I'm doing more and more of them, you know, pretty soon he's whispering in this tape, so I can't hear it. And he goes, it looks like you're driving a truck. So he kept telling me, he goes, as you were doing it faster, instead of doing an upward block, I was coming more this way. So it ended up looking like I'm steering this big, huge truck. And I went home and I plugged that tape in, and I heard him. He goes, looks like you're driving a truck. And I noticed it right away, and bam, fixed my upward blocks. You know, it was like, yeah, hey, I saw it, you know. And so anyways, he was a phenomenal instructor. All the instructors that I had there were really good instructors. I had one named Mark Wilhelm that taught most of the adult classes, a young guy, and just an awesome martial artist. He became a police officer too. And a lot of them, Darby and him, both became full-time SWAT, and they did SWAT. And Darby's retired now. I'm not sure if, I think he still does some stuff with law enforcement, but he moved to Washington and he's got a school down there, and he built a big dojo in the back. I haven't had a chance to be out there to see it yet, but it's pretty cool. So from Darby, he took me up through basically fourth degree black belt, promoted me up through second, but the time frame that you needed in between each rank, I was there every day training. So, you know, he said, you know, I'd promote you, but you don't have the time in, you know, as far as, you know, a year, 2 years. And I did as far as on the mat, because I was there all the time. I wasn't there 2 days a week. I was there 7 days a week. So anyhow, he took me up through second black, and then at fourth black, he was a Ed Parker's black belt too. So he's first generation. He taught me everything, and he goes, You know what? We were already starting to do jiu-jitsu. The Gracies had came here, like I said, started in 86. I got my black belt June 12th, 1993. And then Ed Parker, you know, passed away in 1990. And that, going back a little bit, that was December. I think December 5th, he passed away. And then it came around to the Internationals, first Internationals without Ed Parker. And we were up there, and the Gracies had Helsing Gracie, and I think it was Hickson, that they'd set up a booth at the Internationals and videotape. And they were showing the lions killing, a lion coming out and tackling another lion. And Darby was like, wow, this is perfect, because with the police department, they used to be able to do the chokeholds and all that stuff. So he said, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do with Kempo, elbows and punching, police officers can't do that. But a lot of the grappling stuff they can do with the wrist locks and all the other stuff. So he started taking that and he started adding it into our system. So we did that for, I did it for 7.5 years with Darby, not for belt rank. He was going for belt rank, but we were just doing it for fun. We did an hour jiu-jitsu class every week. And I didn't enjoy it much. I don't really like grappling on the grounds, like wrestling in high school and stuff. As a street fighter, I want to stay on my feet all the time. So that's always been for me. And that's why Ed Parker's system worked so well. In fact, my first night sparring when I got my yellow belt, I was told by the instructor, Mark Wilhelm, we all started sparring and I'm just like going in full blast. You know, I kept going, you know, it's like, I don't back up. And that's the way I learned to street fight. Once my mom always said, my dad, is you don't start a fight, but if somebody throws a punch, you finish it, and you better win. So yeah. You know, I was full blast when I go. Once I start going straight, I just keep going, you know, until somebody falls down or something, and he goes, back off, don't be so aggressive, you know. So I had to work on it a little bit and kind of learn the sparring, moving in and then moving back and moving to the side and not just going just full blast, you know, into whatever it takes. I didn't care if somebody, once I went in and somebody was hit, if somebody was hitting me, I just kept going. It's like, I'm going to get my shot in there. And so that was a big eye opener there. And then, so we did the jiu-jitsu and we did Kempo also. So we were doing both of them. And Parker passed away, so some things started changing at the dojo. We were still teaching the Parker system. It was a 24 technique system, and I learned all of it up, like I said, up through fourth black, or up through third, I guess, was the highest everything went. Mm-hmm. And along with that, while I was doing that, I dabbled in. I did Aikido for about a year, but that wasn't really for me. I just wanted to try everything, kind of see how it fit and what, you know, what works. And there was a lot of applications I could put into the Kempo that worked too. So I did that. I did Muay Thai for 6-7 months. Didn't really care for the Muay Thai either. I liked the fighting, but it just wasn't, you know, my style for me, you know. And I stuck with Kempo, did the jiu-jitsu. I started going over some schools and I'd spar with them. Some guys had Taekwondo schools and I'd share some Kempo. They'd share some Taekwondo. I'd be like, okay, our hands are faster, but your feet are, you know, they got better kicks. So yeah, teach me your kick. I'll teach you some striking or some jiu-jitsu. And I did that at a Taekwondo school too. I did a little bit of everything, worked with the Eskrima sticks, Arnes, pressure points. My latest thing was pressure points, but Darby, as we got going, I wanted to open up a school. I decided, you know, hey, this is for me, you know, I'm here all the time. So I talked to Darby about it. And at that time they were getting ready to close down the school in Lemon Grove, cause it was just financially, I wasn't making any money or anything. And there was another person involved in there that I didn't really see eye to eye with, so it wasn't really working out. So I went and opened up another school, and just from scratch. And I didn't tell any students I was going. I just bowed out one day, went over and opened up a school. One of the guys went with me and opened it up at the beginning with me. And we had 840 square feet. It was a little place, and there was a couple walls in between. And when I showed it to him, Tom Ehrensberg, he looked at it and he goes, "Gary, this isn't big enough for a karate school. Each room's like, 10 foot by 20, I ain't gonna work, And I said, "No, I'm knocking these walls out." And I had the whole idea, and he goes, "Okay, we'll go for it. I trust you, whatever you do." So we knocked it all down and built a little office, a little dressing room, and it worked. And we did that for about 2.5 years. And then the school grew, and I got offered to go into a school. It was 2,000 square feet down the street with a really good price. So we moved down there. And I did that for, I think, about 17 years down there. And they started raising the rent, doubling it, tripling it, to the point of just made it to where I couldn't afford it. The place next door was a funeral parlor, so we had a pretty good setup. We knock them out, take them next door. No. But they started doing a lot of gangbanger funerals and stuff, and it brought a lot of, bad blood into the neighborhood. So I had a lot of parents and people that didn't want to really train there anymore because they were scared to come. I was walking them out to their cars. One night, one of the parents came in and said there was two rivalry gangs that were out there, and they're getting ready to fight. And there's like 15 of each gang, they're getting ready to go at it. And I'm not thinking anything. I'm just thinking protect my school, my family, my students are my family. And so I go running out the door. I go out there. I'm like, "Hey, what's going on? Break it up." And I get in the middle, and they're all looking at me really weird, like, and they all kind of back up and stuff, and I got it broke up. And then I turn around, I start walking back into the dojo, and I realize I'm wearing my karate gi, my belt, and everything else, and it's like, these guys could have guns, knives, whatever. But after that, it just, the studio dropped off. I had 166 students at the peak, and we dropped down to like 45 students. I'm like, I can't afford it anymore. The rent was skyrocketing, like $4,500, $5,000 a month. It was more money going out of my pocket than it was. So my last resort, I found a place here in Spring Valley at 1,340 square feet, I think it is. Perfect little school. It's nice. Mm-hmm. And, the owner was really cool. And, in between that, I kind of go back a little bit, miss him, was, so Darby, when he closed down the school, I started training under Willie Steele. He wanted me to start working out with him. So Willie Steele was first generation at Parker Black Belt too. And he passed away a couple of years ago. And he was with me for quite a while. He took me from actually promoted me to third all the way up through seventh degree black. And he was under Dave Hebler, senior grandmaster Dave Hebler at the time. And which is, I don't know if you know who he is, but Dave's highest rank in black belt besides Chuck Sullivan, I believe, right now, that's still alive, under Ed Parker. So anyways, he, at the same time, he was around 96. I met, Grandmaster Dave Hebler, and he's like, "Hey, you got to come train with me and work out with us." And Willie was already up there working out with him. And so I joined the association that was, at that time, it was the original American Kenpo Karate Association. And he acknowledged me into, I was second degree black as far as my rank. I had the material, but that was my rank at the time. So he acknowledged me into the system as second degree black belt. And then I had the grand opening, and I was doing some privates with him up in Hemet, and working with Willie Steele at the same time. And then, when I opened up my school, he came for my grand opening, and it was really funny because he told me I'd passed flyers out everywhere. I walked out like 2,000 flyers. I'm like, I'm going to do this. I didn't have much money. I had enough just to get school opened. I borrowed a little bit from mother-in-law and got it opened. So I passed out these flyers, and the day that we were doing the grand opening, he brought down the whole association. Everybody came in. There was a whole bunch of guys, and they all supported me. And he said, "Don't expect to sign anybody up on your grand opening. It just doesn't happen. You're here just to kind of celebrate the opening of your school." And people started coming in, they wanted to sign up for classes. And I'm like, wow, you know, and Dave's just like, I can't believe you're signing people up. So I had a line going in my door. In my office, you could only go in through the front door into the office. My desk was wall to wall because it was so small. That's how I had to build it. And so Dave kept going, hurry up, you know, and I'm going through, I don't know how to sign anybody at this point. You know, I'm like, okay, it's this much a month for lessons, and it's this much for the uniform, and it's this much for this, and this much for the association, you know, all these, like, I'm dinging them for all these little things, you know, but they're signing up. And he, after that was all over, he pulls me about halfway through, pulled me out and acknowledged me and kicked me for second degree black belt in the association. And then he pulled me aside and he goes, I got to teach you something about signing people up. He goes, you put it together as a package. This, you get all this stuff. This is how much it is. And this is how much it is per month. And he says, just shut up. And then just ask them how they want to pay. And man, that took all the hard work out of spending an hour trying to, you know, I'm telling everybody about every single thing there is, you know, and simplified things. So really smart businessman. And so from there, you know, I was in the association, and then he made me something in the association. I can't remember what it was, but he gave me some kind of a director title and organizer or something. And then that association closed down, and I went up in rank, and we moved to the other school. And at a certain point, let me see what happened. I actually, Willie Steele was moving to Alabama. And so Grandmaster Hebler took me on as his student at that point. And I had went to Tennessee, and I was around doing seminars all over the place. I was just, there was a year I was just, I don't know, from state to state to state, just doing workshops and seminars everywhere. And I came back, and I was really kind of bummed. I'd done one at a tempo school, and I wasn't real impressed with what everybody was doing. And I also did a couple of Taekwondo schools, and I'm like, these guys are moving really well. Their kicks look really good. Everything's sharp, but they don't really have as much, you know. And in Kempo, you know, 24 techniques per belt. I mean, it's a lot. And I already broke the system down a little bit to 16 techniques per belt because I really wanted the quality. I didn't want everybody spending so much time on so many techniques. I wanted their basics to be really good. And I'd gone over it with Willie Steele when we started that. And he agreed. He was still kind of, you know, Ed Parker, 24 techniques, this is the way you do it. But I said, you know what? I said, I really believe 16 techniques, web of knowledge, everything. I tried to follow everything, put everything in order that way. Teach only the basics that are in yellow belt, only the orange belt basics, and kind of maneuvered a little bit that way, which worked really well, but it's still, I'm a real stickler on the basics, so I want things to be perfect, and it still took a long time. My first yellow belt, my first school, took a year and a half to get him there. And the guy was coming 3 days a week. And he was like, oh, my God, this just takes forever to get anywhere, you know. And then that's where I got to lighten up on it a little bit. They're not going to be black belts at yellow belt, you know. And he was a really good yellow belt, him and his wife. So we stuck with the 16 technique system, which worked really good, that we put together. And then when I went to the bigger school, after I came back from that workshop, I thought about it on the plane and I thought, you know what? I just think that there's too much material as far as, I'm a street fighter in self-defense, and I wanted to train people to be able to protect themselves out on the street. Not much of a forms guy. Forms are necessary. I mean, there's a lot that you learn and you get out of the principles and concepts and movement with forms. So I'm not saying that you don't need forms, but my thing is really the fighting, and it had always been sparring, competing. I refereed at the internationals, and I tried to do everything I could, you know, throughout the years. So when I came back, Grandmaster Hebler had actually left and went to Thailand, and he was doing a movie. And that was, Joe Lewis was actually in that movie. He'd gotten brain cancer, and it was one of the last things I think he did. And so Grandmaster Helbler was working on that movie. Before he got there, he was choreographing fight scenes and stuff. It was called White Tiger. It never came out. I guess there was maybe a financial. Movies always, you know, they get to a certain point, they either make it or don't. And so he got a hold of me and he said, hey, I need a place to stay. You know, you got any ideas? And I'm like, I don't have room in my house, but I said, I got a motorhome parked outside that you stay in for about 3 months till we start doing some traveling. And he said, hey, that's good enough. And so he sent me his plane arrangements. I went and picked him up at the airport, brought him back. He lived here with me for in the motorhome for about 3 months. And then he moved in with Tom here and stayed in San Diego. So I had him pretty close by for a while. I got to do a lot of stuff. So while he was here, I came back from doing the workshops. And he told me, say, Gary, you know, so let me come in. He goes, how did it go? And I said, well, let me grab a beer and I'll be out there. He said, okay. So we sat down and I gave him beer and I said, you know, I got to talk to you about something. And he goes, okay. And I said, you know what? I said, I'm pretty straightforward on things. I said, you are too. So I said, I'm going to tell you something that I have an idea for. If you don't like it, punch me in the face, you know? And he goes, okay, I will. And he would have. So I sat there and I told him, I said, you know, I think I need to put together a system. Today's environment, I just don't see people coming in like when I was training. Nobody's doing it anymore. They come 2 days a week, maybe three if you got somebody that's really, really into it. But to get 24 techniques to do them the way I feel you should be doing them, it's going to take me 50 years to get a black belt, you know, out of somebody. So I said, I was at these schools. I told them what happened with the workshops. And I said, I think the whole problem is I feel people got to spend more time on the basics and they got to understand the technique. And I need to be able to break it down for them and make sure that they can move properly and they got the balance and they can generate the power and they understand that power is coming from the hips. You got to rotate your hips. I said, you know, that's how Parker moved. So I said, I want to put together a system that's got less techniques. And I had told him, I said, I think, you know, I can do it with 8 to 10 techniques. And he took the beer and he slammed it on the table and beer went everywhere. And he's looking at me and I'm like, oh, he's pissed. And then he goes, it's a great idea. I've always wanted to do that. So he goes, Chuck did that. Chuck Sullivan. He goes, he does video stuff, but he kind of the same thing. He's got, I think, 56 techniques. And he looked at me and he goes, but that's, you want too many techniques. You need to break it down more. So we broke it down and he came down with me and another instructor that I had that I trained with at Lemon Grove, awesome fighter, David Stewart. And he helped us. And me and Dave Stewart would pound out the techniques and Helbler would watch and he would say, that's good, that's bad. You know, let's do this, let's try that. And we changed some of the techniques and did little things and picked what techniques we thought in the family grouping and everything would work out with a smaller system, not as big. And we and that's kind of what we put together. And so we came up with 4.46. And what's funny is Jeff Speakman came up with 5.0, like right before that. And we were trying to we were going to do, we were just going to call it 4.46. And I said, well, you know, we need to kind of add to that. Let's, you know, he said, well, why don't you do original Kempo? First, he said original American Kempo Karate Association. I said, Dave, that was your old association. He had sold that to Greg Townsley. So I said, I can't use American. And I said, you know, we got some other stuff in there too. So let's just call it original Kempo Karate because we were kind of taking it back to the basics of talking to him and Chuck Sullivan. I went up and met with him and Vic LaRue and we talked and they were like, yeah, you should do this. So I said, you know, I kind of want to take it back to the roots of Kempo because the guys back in the early 60s, late 50s, the old timers, they were hardcore. It was hardcore. It was good Kempo. It was not that it's not good now, but it's just putting the time in. You know, they were like 2 years and they would make a black belt and they'd be really good black belts and they didn't have as many techniques. And then everything started because it started, I believe Dave and Chuck said that it was white, yellow, brown, and black. And then they added it in orange and then it kind of grew from there. And then it got too big and then it got smaller, you know. And Chuck Sullivan told me, he said, you know, he had talked to to Ed Parker after he came back from doing Perfect Weapon. And Ed Parker said that he had to do something because he had been to a couple schools doing some workshops and tests, I think. And he just said, I'm seeing the techniques, but I'm hearing the names, but I don't identify the techniques as what I'm really teaching. Because it was really, if you think about it, Pasadena, San Diego, we were close. So we were pretty much on key with it. But when it's back in all these other states, he's not spending as much time. And there's no videotapes. There's no video conferencing that you could do to work with anybody back then. So, and he really wanted people to take it and kind of move the way they moved. So a lot of things got changed. So, you know, my thing was to try to keep it as good as I possibly could. So the 4.46, what it stood for is four forms up to black belt. From black belt, I add a lot more stuff into it, but just to get to black belt. My thing was to get somebody to black belt and be a quality black belt and to be able to defend himself out in the street, that I taught him something. And I really felt like at Orange and Purple, we were losing people because it was, and by that time, a lot of purple belts in Ed Park's system back in those days, they were better than some of the black belts that I was seeing in tournaments and stuff, is because we were putting that much time into it to get to that point. So I really wanted a, you know, quality martial art. So, and something good. And the Parker system was just awesome. And it was like street fighting, what I learned up close and personal. And so we took the best that we could. We put together 46 techniques to black belt. Doesn't seem like much. I get students now telling me, it's like, God, there's so much material. And I'm like, this is like nothing, you know, but the quality that I wanted at is different. So we do four forms and 46 techniques. And I put together this with Hebler, and we thought it was a great idea, but it didn't really work out real well over the years. I've changed it. Was we didn't do any of the traditional forms. We were having them work on their techniques more. So we had them take out their every technique they learned, they had to create their own form and do it right and left side. And that way I figured that they're working those techniques. They're getting better at their techniques because they're pounding them out in their forms. But it was confusing them right and left side at the beginning, and it didn't work out real good. So a few years later, I brought back in short form one, long form one. We do two, and we do form three, and then we do long form four. And that's as far as we take it, as far as with the forms. I think most everything that you really need, if you haven't got it out of it by that time, the other forms, they're good forms, but I don't really think that you're learning as much more as what you're going to learn through those forms. And so we put those back in, and it's worked really, really well. And so with the kids, I do half ranks even, you know, so they only learn three techniques and then they test for a half yellow, but they have to learn all those basics that are in those techniques. And it doesn't seem like much, but if you take those first three techniques and you break down every single basic, that's quite a bit at the beginning to be learning to as far as basics. So yellow belt's still a very hard belt. And most people have agreed with me that, you know, it's worked out really well. Anybody has came in and sat on one of my tests, they're just like, wow, you know, this is awesome. They're doing really good. So I've had really good, you know, feedback on the system, you know, so it's I think a really good system. And along with it, a few years ago, I started taking pressure points and training in Sistema with David Snyder. And that really opened my eyes to a lot of things as far as movement and the pressure points that were actually are in the Kempo system that you don't really see, you know, and I really focus on that a little more. I try to make every student understand what they're doing, how they're doing it, and understand the fact that when somebody dummies for a technique, and it's funny, Grandmaster Hebler wanted to take that word away, but I can't think of anything else but dummy. And you know, I say, you're like a stuntman in the movie, you know? So I tell them, I say, when you get punched in the face, you're not going to stand there. I see this happen on black belt tests all the time. You know, they throw the attack and the guy stands there and he throws a punch. And I say, you know what? When the punch comes towards your face, lean back on your heels and see where you end up. Because if I punch you in the face, you're going to go back on your heels and you're going to take a step back. And that puts more reality into where they're going to end up. So we try to make it as realistic as we possibly can of what's really going to happen. I try to get them to understand a dummy. And when I say it, it's the, I feel the importance of dummying for a technique is as important as a technique, because if you hit, you learn how to go with it. As you're dummying for that technique, you're learning how to move. Your body's moving. You'll be able to take that punch a lot better than just standing there and taking a full-blown punch, you know, across the jaw. And so that's kind of the way we do that. And we put it together. I got a smaller school now. I trained with the association, all those guys, when it was the original Kenpo Karate Association, original American Kenpo Karate Association up in Hemet. We all got together and pounded out techniques. And then eventually that kind of, he shut it down and there was nothing for a while. And then he opened up the gift of power, he called it, another association. That one didn't go over real well. I joined that one too. And then, Trevor Sherman, another guy, wanted Dave to open an association again after he shut down the Gift of Power. And I told him for years, call it Dave Hebler's Kenpo Karate Association, because everybody knows who you are, you know, or most people. And so he did. Trevor, I think, talked him into doing that. And so as the association started growing, we got quite a few schools that were on board. And then he made me and Dave Prosser, a good friend of mine. And I was very lucky I got to meet Dave Prosser. I don't know if you've heard Dave Prosser, tremendous fighter. And so me and him are really, really good friends. He was the best man at my wedding. And he came down, I met him. That was when we acknowledged Dave as a senior grandmaster at my school. And we had Paul Dye down there and... oh, got a few people too. Pretty big workshop. Frank Trejo and I can't remember who all was there, but we had quite a few in attendance. And so he was acknowledged and then when I moved the or I was still in the school, we did the 446, and then Dave made me the president of his association. I had a lot of dreams for it. I wanted it to grow and get bigger. And Dave Prosser was vice president. AC Rainey was on board. Todd Durgan. We had quite a few guys. And I did that for a few years. And then when I moved the school down here to Spring Valley and, you know, I wanted to do other stuff with the association, you know, Dave says, he goes, yeah, you should open up your own association. Yeah, sure, what would I call it? You know, and he goes, well, I'll call it Original American Kenpo. I said, well, you can't, because you sold that, you know. He goes, okay, call it Original Kenpo Karate. So the same thing as, you know, your title, we call it Original Kenpo Karate 4.46. So I did, and I started my own association. I've had that for a few years now. The four forms, 4.46, 46 techniques, to get through black belt, plus all the basics and sets and everything else. It's still pretty good sized system. But what I was saying earlier with Jeff Speakman was he had started the 5.0 right before we called it 4.46. And I didn't think anything of it. And I, at the time, computer and software, everything was 1.0, 1.5, you know, and that, I think that's kind of where we just, I was, we're like, hey, 4.46. Yeah. And then I had people calling me and they're like, so your system, Jeff Speakman's is an upgrade from your system. And I'm like, an upgrade? And I never even really put it together. I go, yeah, yours is 4.46, his is 5.0. So his is an upgrade from the 4.4. I said, no, they have nothing to do with anything whatsoever. Jeff has his system and I got my system. 5.0 is what he calls it. And I call mine 4.46 because it forms in the sets. And so we moved into the school down here and we've been training out of there for, God, I think about 8 years now. And that's been working out really good. And I got some other directions I'm trying to take, you know, Kenpo too. You know, I've always had in my mind that I wanted Kenpo to be the biggest system. You know, it's like, I just want to get the word out there. And it's just, it's an awesome system, whether you're doing 24 techniques, you're doing you know, 6 techniques per belt, 16. It really doesn't matter the principles and the concepts and how it's taught and the basics. And, you know, I really look at it, you know, if Ed Parker was still alive, I'd be teaching whatever Ed Parker was teaching now. If it was 24 techniques, it'd be 24. I'd be sticking to whatever he's doing. But, you know, things changed, and I had a hard time with it changing for a long time. You know, I read all the black belt magazines back when there was, you know, an actual magazine you could physically open up, and I think they're doing it a little bit now again. I don't know, but every single magazine after Parker died, I still have it, and there's an article in there. Oh, it's going to fall apart. This is going to happen. That's going to happen. This, I'm like, no, Kempo's strong. It's, you know, but there's a lot of politics involved with it, and everybody wanted to go their own way, and that's good. You know, it grew, and you know, Ed Parker always said it was a progressive system, you know, and it should change with the times. I don't know if he'd agree with what I do, but I think he would. Everybody that I pretty much have dealt with, they say, you know, he was, like I said, Chuck Sullivan, when he met with them right before he passed away and took off to Hawaii, Chuck Sullivan had met with him, and he said he was, you know, changing the system. He had the 16 technique system in place, but he hadn't finished it. Somebody finished it up. I'm not sure who, but, Chuck said he told him at that point that he was going to do the 16 technique system, and in a few years he was going to minus some of that out. He was going to break it down more so that it could be, you know, back to a real quality, you know, strong system. And there's a lot of very quality black belts out there. I'm not saying there isn't. It's just whether you're going to put the time into it or not. You know, you put the time into it, 24 techniques. I mean, you've got an arsenal. I mean, it's huge, you know, and then while he was coming up, I mean, we were changing. I mean, Ed Parker would call up and he'd come down and he'd say, you know, hey, we're adding, you know, we're changing this technique, 5 swords. Now you're going to go to a forward bow here instead of a twist stance or whatever it was. So, you know, there was always things progressing that were happening. And Grandmaster Hebler told me back, him, Chuck, and all the guys, when they were training, that the system wasn't just Ed Parker that created all the techniques. It was all of his black belts. When they used to have their Friday night class or the line or whatever, and they'd all get together and they would talk about the techniques and they'd create the techniques as they would go. And that's, they'd pound them out on each other and see if they worked. And if they did, then they got put into the system. So that's kind of where I'm at. My wife, I've been married a couple times. Karate's kind of not been great with Kempo, but, you know, things happen. So, I'm with my last and final one. She's awesome. She, actually took karate with me where my first wife didn't. She supported me doing it, but she didn't want any part of it. Second one got a little bit involved, and that was just a disaster. But my wife now, she trained with me. She didn't actually, her son was 3 years old, came in. I started a 3- and 4-year-old class, and she brought him in to train, and he didn't really care for it much. He didn't stick with it. And then his sister came in, and she was older, and she stuck with it for quite a bit. I got her almost to brown belt. And then Alba, my wife, came in, and we had got, they did this big thing. I think it was News 8. And they did this huge, everybody call in and say what number one school in San Diego is. And I won. That's when I had a lot of students. And so I got number one for the year of being top school in San Diego. And so News 8, News 10, I don't know which one it was. One of them, they came in and they actually filmed me for free and gave me a video. I had it on my website for years, but I recently took it down because it was so outdated. And so I didn't have many adults because 9/11 really killed all my adults. I was teaching police officers because at Lemon Grove, that's all we did was we had a police program that we put together, and we were teaching a lot of police officers out of there, San Diego police, sheriffs, and Navy SEALs, taught almost everybody. And so the 9/11 hit, and I had more adults than I had kids. And our Tuesday night sparring class was just, everybody came around, all from all around, just to do the sparring class. And 9/11 hit, and adults are gone. Military's gone. Police are down to the airport. I had the chief of police that was training down there, and he was running everything down at the airport. But then a lot of the military people brought their kids in while they were gone. So we ended up growing our kids' class. And then I got to the point where, man, I want to build my adult class back up. So when News 10 came in, I had more kids than I had adults. I only had maybe, I had more black belts probably than anything, instructors. I think I had 4 or 5 instructors, and then I had maybe 5 or 6 adults. But like I said, I had like 166 students, so it was all mainly kids. So I asked Alba at the time, I said, hey, if I give you a uniform, she wasn't training. She trained when she was a kid in Mexico. But I said, hey, if I give you a uniform, I'll give you a free uniform and a free month if you jump in on this video so we can look like we got some adult students, you know. And so she goes, yeah, I'll do it for you. No problem. I don't want anything. So she did. She came out and she did it. And she was on the video. And then the next day she comes over and hands me the uniform. And she goes, thanks, but I really don't want to train, you know, for my kids and this and that. And I had put together a kickboxing conditioning class. And we were kind of going at it pretty hard with the kickboxing class. And she came in and she goes, you know what? Can I get that uniform back? I'd kind of like to do your kickboxing class. Would that be okay? And I said, yeah, come in and do it. Try it out. And she did. And then she wanted to start training from me in Kempo. So then she started doing the Kempo. And now she's a 5th degree black belt under me and going for her 6th in August. And she teaches the kids and the adults, mainly the kids down at the school. And phenomenal instructor. She enjoys it. And, you know, she's bilingual. So, you know, we got Spanish speaking, you know, students that can come to her class, and it works out pretty good. But, you know, my heart and soul's into Kempo. It's like, it'll never go away. I told her, I said, I'll never retire. You know, I'm working with her right now because when COVID hit, it really hit the school hard. We lost half of our students during that. And the owner that was at that school was really cool. So, he actually cut my rent in half while we were going through COVID. So I was able to keep the school afloat, and we did online classes, and I learned a lot from that. Good thing I learned to do techniques right and left-sided, because when you're doing it online, you know, it's about the only way everybody understands it is doing it that way. So we survived COVID, and the students that were there now are, most of them are black belts now. They made it through, and you know, I actually taught the two, I don't know if you ever learned the two-man set, but I taught the two-man set to two of my brown belts that were, teenagers at the time. And they're not at each other's house, but they were friends. And I taught it to them online, and I thought, I don't know how this is going to come out when we get back in the school, because it's a two-man set. You got two people there. They came back in, and it worked out really good. Within, I would say, about 3 weeks, they were nailing it. They had it. And I'm like, oh, it worked, you know. I taught one of the students Form 4 online, and, you know, but the difference is, if you understand it, you got the basics, you know, it wasn't too much of a problem to teach online. And if you've got two people, then it works out pretty good. I've got husband and wife that I teach online on a regular basis. And they're really good at it. They can actually do stuff on each other. So, you know, it's almost like being in a class. So.
Yeah. If you have that foundation, it's a lot easier to pick up the other items online, or, you know, in a video, in a remote way, versus just, you know, starting out fresh. That wouldn't be the recommended way of learning. But if you've already have that base, yeah, like it, online is totally doable. And yeah, the whole COVID and everything showed opened a lot of people's eyes to, oh yeah, we can do this stuff remotely. And so
yeah,
So it was a good learning experience, I think.
Yeah. One person, I had one guy come online and it was impossible. He wasn't real coordinator or anything else, and trying to teach somebody, not that he couldn't learn, but in person he would get it. But online it was too difficult. So I just kind of cut that off. I'm like, you really need to find a school close by and go in there and train from somebody there where you can do some hands-on stuff. And Grandmaster Hevler actually took me from, he promoted me to 8th, 9th degree black belt. And then I was acknowledged by my peers to Grandmaster back in, I think, 22. Actually, A.C. Rainey, Grandmaster Dave Prosser, he came down and Bob Austin, I think he's a professor up in Colorado. He's got huge school. I think he's kind of retired from the school part, but he's still part of his association. Really good martial artist. And they were all down there and acknowledged me, the Grandmaster. And so, and Chuck Sullivan signed my certificate, and Joe Ribello and Ted Sumner. And I ended up at the Hall of Fame, and everybody's coming up because Paul Casey was going to sign it. And while I had it out, you know, Ted Sumner's like, hey, what is that? And he's like, hey, I want to sign it, you know. So he signed it. So I got quite a few acknowledgments on it. So it was pretty cool. But it's not the end of the road. You know, it's like black belt. You know, I try to tell students the worst thing. And I talked to Ted Sumner about this at the Hall of Fame one day when we were talking. We were out having a couple of drinks. And I said, have you ever had anybody make black belt and then drop out? And he goes, oh, my God, yeah, it's the worst thing. I said, oh, my God, it took my heart away. I said, I promoted I had a black belt test quite a while ago, but I promoted, I think there was 5 or 6 that made black on that day. And they've been training for 5, 6 years. And I kind of had a feeling with one of them. It was a female. And so she came in right before the test and she goes, you know, I want to pay for my test and I want to fill out my cancellation form. I'm like, what? She goes, yeah. She goes, my goal was black belt. I got it and on to other things now. I'm like, wow, this is like the beginning of your journey. You're just, you know, it's like a doctor that just graduated college. You haven't got hands on yet really in there, you know, doing surgery or anything. And then I had the other one, it was him and his son. His son dropped out right away. He was going to college, so it's kind of understandable. And he stayed for a while, but work kind of took him away from it. But other than that, most of my black belts, I've got, I think, about 50 black belts on my family tree now. And they all fade in and out here and there. You know, I've got the core ones that stay with it. And a lot of them got older. Guys that I sparred with that were 10 years older than me that, back in the day, you know, it's like Rick Monjay, you know, he was a big Rick. He's a tough fighter. Me and him, he was my sparring partner for a long time. And he was here in San Diego and he's gotten older now, you know, and I saw him at my Christmas party and I go, man, I miss those days. And he goes, yeah, I can't do that stuff anymore. You know, it's really hard. You know, you get that point. He said, we should come in and teach, you know, just because you can't do it anymore. You can still teach. Got to pass that art on to everyone. To me, that's passing on your knowledge. That's the biggest part of the whole thing. And I love teaching. So I say, I'll never retire. I told Elba, I said, you know, I'll always be doing Kempo. You know, it's just got to change the level. You know, some things you can do and some things you can't. You know, I mean, Dave Prosser used to go and just beat the crap out of each other. You know, he's up in Gardnerville, Nevada. And that's a real funny story. I'm going to say real quick. When I met Dave Prosser, he's a tough guy. He likes to get hit. You can hit him as hard as you want to, and he enjoys it. He'll smile. I hit him once where he didn't smile so much, but most times. So when we first met, he goes, you got to come up to my school, Gardnerville, come up. We'll do some shooting. I got all these guns, and I live near the mountains. And he goes, come into my school and spar. So I go there, and at this time, Grandmaster Hebler had moved back to Gardnerville, Nevada. He always loved Gardnerville, Nevada. And so I'm visiting kind of the both of them. And so me and Dave tell him, we're taking him back to his room, and we'd had lunch, and he goes, well, you know, what are you guys going to do? And Dave goes, well, we're going back to my school. We're going to spar, you know? And Hebler goes, no. And we're like, what? He goes, no, I don't. You guys are both my friends and students. And he goes, Dave's a Golden Glove fighter, and he's a kick-ass fighter. And he goes, Gary's a brawler, a total street fighter. He goes, the two of you guys fighting together is just not good. He goes, it'll be bad. It'll be really bad, you know? And he goes, I want you guys to remain being friends. We're like, no, we're good. And he's like, no, you got to make me a promise. I'm not going to go take my nap if you don't make me that promise. We're like, all right, yeah, we'll do that, you know? So Dave gets out of the truck. I get back in. I jump in Prosser's truck, and he looks at me, and he goes, you ready? And I said, yeah, I got to stop by Walmart. I need a mouthpiece. So we went down there. I walked into his school. And I've never had a fear of fighting anybody. It's like, no matter, I don't care how big you are or whatever, it doesn't change anything. But I walked into his school, and I look, and there's blood all over the mirrors, dried up blood. I mean, splattered everywhere. And it was a small school. And I'm like, what's all this? And he goes, oh, the other night we were sparring, and one guy broke his nose, and the other guy ruptured his spleen and had to go to the hospital. And I'm like, oh, maybe I picked the wrong guy to spar with. Maybe Hebler had a point here, you know? But yeah, I'm not going to back down. So I go in the bathroom to change, and there's blood all over the sink and blood all over the mirror and blood all over the toilet. And I'm like, oh, man, what did I get myself into? And I went out there, and we both squared off, and we both fought pretty close to the same, you know? Dave's a hard hitter. I like hitting hard. We hit in the face. We hit, you know, we hit everywhere. But the difference is he's a mile high. In San Diego, we're not a mile high. So my breathing was nothing like what Dave Prosser's was. So we go for about 2 minutes. I'm running out of air. I said, we got to take a break, you know, because otherwise he's going to kill me. So we take a break, and we went back in. We just kept going back in. I'd keep going, okay, I need air. I need air. I got to get some more. I need air. And we went for a couple hours at it, just pounding each other, and then we back got Hebler, and our faces all red and everything. He goes, you guys sparred. And we're like, yeah. Well, that was great. Me and Dave, every time we go, we'll do workshops together. Me and him do seminars and workshops together, and we key off each other, because if I get stuck on something, he keeps going. If he gets stuck, I keep going, and we try to keep it as lively as we can. The last one we did for Todd Durgan, AC Rainey was up there in the hallway, and we're getting ready for it. We were just beating the crap out of each other before we went in for the seminar. So, it was fun. But that's old school. You know, I like the old school training, but, you know, can't do that anymore, you know, as far as my school goes. Good control. And, you know, I tell everybody, don't punch in the face. Nobody wants bloody nose and go home. You know, it's like, not that accidents don't happen, but we try to control everything. But you're here. You were from San Diego too, right? So you started out here.
Yes, yes. I'm from San Diego. As we talked about earlier, my first instructor was a Sweet Pete Salas, and started in. I was at that school for about 2 or 3 years. Just almost to my third brown when I left for the Army. And fortunately or unfortunately, I had about a 25 plus year gap in between Kempo schools. The instructor that I train with now is in the so with Mr. Salas. I guess lineage is sort of that of the Tracy version, and the instructor that I train with now is the Ed Parker, you know, American Kempo lineage. So cool. When I started at the at this school, I had to start over again, which at first I was not a fan of, but I've come to learn and really appreciate that. So at this point I'm working back to working towards my third brown, And then I also am cross training. So I recently started doing Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and I'm also doing Hapkido as well.
Awesome.
And I also have a little bit of Taekwondo, and I did some boxing a little bit in the Army. And then I guess my other core style is that of Capoeira. And nice. I've been doing that for 17 years now. So so I'm trying to stay well-rounded, but there's only so many hours in the day that that I can do all of these things. So,
but it's in your blood, you know?
Yeah, that's, I mean, I love it.
Still, yeah. Once you start doing it, you either do it or you don't. You know, it's like I hear people say they're going to come back and then they never do, you know? It's hard for people to come back after they leave. So,
yeah,
you know, hats off to you. I'm glad you're sticking with it. Out of all the systems, I've tried probably 15, 16 different systems. And for me, the only thing that I found that really works in the street, you know, that is American Kenpo. You know, it's a, you know, it's up close and personal in the way attacks happen out on the street and mass attacks, you know, because, you know, the jiu-jitsu wasn't really for me because I don't like fighting on the ground. And I always stayed away from, I don't think I was ever in a street fight where I went to the ground. I always stayed on my feet. And I asked Helsing Gracie when I was doing Rondori with him one time, Grandmaster Helsing Gracie. And I said, what do you guys do if it's multiple attacks? And he said, do Kenpo. Why would you go to the ground if you're, you know, you can't fight more than one guy? Because if one guy's got you tied up, you got two or three guys kicking you. And on my second degree black belt test, Darby had kind of entwined jiu-jitsu with Kenpo. So we were fighting and the thing was, it was 2-on-1. So one of the guys had to take me to the ground. And I don't know how old I was in, 26, 27, and maybe 28. And so both guys I was fighting, one was 16 years old. And he came in from the kids' class at 12 because he was so big and a really good fighter, Danny, and another guy named Mike Kassab, and he was a really good fighter, and he was a couple years younger than me, and but hardcore fighters. And so, you know, we fought, and then, boom, they took me to ground, and I kept fighting, but, you know, Mike's on top of me, punching me in the face, and I get Danny kicking me in the ribs, you know, and not super hard, but hard enough that it hurt. And so, yeah, I'm trying to get out of it, and I'm trying to roll, and I end up rolling on my stomach. Worst place to be, right, on your back. And so he's trying to get a chokehold on me, and Darby gets down on the floor, and he gets right in my face, and he's looking at me. He goes, Gary, all you got to do is stand up, and it's all over. Just like, just stand up and it's all over. And I'm just thinking, yeah, easy for you to say. This is like my third or fourth fight for my second black, and I'm totally exhausted. And then I just mentally, I just jumped up and I threw the guys off of me. And I remember punching Mike in the, I think it was a forehead. I caught him and he backed up, and Darby's like, break. And he goes, see, that's all you had to do. And it's like, yeah, sounds easy, but it's not that easy. So stand-up fighting for me, that's, you know, that's my thing. But, you know, I see, you know, ground fighting, you know, there's different aspects of every part of martial arts that's good. And being well-rounded, I think, is really well.
Yeah, so. I'm all about cross-training and having as many things in your toolbox as you can. Yeah, you're probably not going to use, you know, half of it. 75% of it, but having the option to use all of those things, I think is good and important. And I think it's important to be versed in all ranges of combat. And
exactly,
you know, there's all these debates about, oh, well, this is going to work and that's going to work, and you know, we could do that all day. But I think, you know, it doesn't hurt to have options and various ways to deal with things. So
yeah, never, yeah, I like never having know it all. You end up on the ground, so you know, ground training's good. Gotcha. And there's a lot of Kenpo that you can use on the ground, if you think about it. It's a lot of stand-up jiu-jitsu we do that works. Mm-hmm. You know, I found that when I was doing it, as, you know, try some of your Kenpo stuff when you're down on the ground. I did a MMA class for a while because MMA was getting so big. It was like, well, I'm not getting any students. So I put together an MMA class and I changed it around. I made it more of a street fighting MMA. And a couple of the guys that trained with me, they're like, man, you got the most nasty jiu-jitsu I've ever seen. Because I was doing stuff like taking the middle knuckle, driving it into the ribs, vibrating punches. I take my thumb, wrap it around a rib. You know, it's like, you can't do that stuff. I'm like, in the street, I can do anything I want. You know, that's what you got to be exactly. aware of.
Exactly. Exactly. So, man, there's that's a good thing about talking Kenpo is that we could do it all day long and sure. all night long. And even though I have plenty of tape, we're gonna go ahead and move into our lightning round here as we head towards a wrap up, and then we'll talk about a schedule in a part two, because there are some items that I wanted to make sure that I cover, but we won't get to them this time, but we'll talk after this to schedule a part two and get to some of those points. But as for the lightning round, just got a few little questions here to throw at you.
Sure.
First one being, do you have a favorite technique?
Favorite technique, probably snapping twig.
Ah, it's a good one. That one's brought up a lot. Many guests have picked that, so. That's a good one. I like it. Yeah. I like it. Next question. Do you have a favorite form and or set?
Form four, Mr. Parker's signature form. I think it's now they're all good, but I think that one, it's so fluid and there's techniques in it, you know, so I like all the movement that you create in that one. It's generating a lot of power. As far as sets, probably stance set. I've modified ours a little bit, but I like stance set.
I think that one's brought up quite a few times, as I recall. I can think of probably at least two or three of my previous guests have picked stance sets. That's a good one. I like it. All right. Next question. Do you have a favorite weapon?
Probably the knife, because I think I really like to work on knife disarms. I think it's the one weapon that, you know, a gun is very dangerous, but if I can redirect, you know, that's all you got to do is that little movement to get it redirected. I mean, if you get shot, that's bad news, but with the knife, it's all over you. So, you know, if you don't get it just right, you don't have a hold of it, that knife can just be slicing you into pieces so easy. So I try to work the knife a lot. And I like the stick a lot too, but the stick and the knife, to me, they both kind of work the same directions and the same movements as a stick is a knife. You train kind of the same way.
Very nice. I like it. All right. Next question. If there is anyone that you could train with, living or dead, we're going to stick to this. This question originally was one question, but I've now broken it up into two. So any person, whether you've trained with them or not, these are going to be non-fictional people. The second part of the question is just going to be fictional characters. But if there's anyone you could train with, living or dead, who would, besides Ed Parker, who would that be?
Besides Ed Parker, okay, that was going to be my choice.
Yeah, I when I first started doing the show, I just opened it up to anybody and not really thinking about the fact that this is primarily a Kenpo show. And so, yes, everyone is going to say Ed Parker. So I figured I needed to challenge my guests a little bit and take Ed Parker off the table. So, anyone besides Ed Parker, because that's a given.
Well, who would that be? Ed Parker, I would say Bruce Lee.
Very nice, very nice. Yes, he's often picked, and rightly so. So I like it. I like it. Right. So then, the second part of that question is a fictional character if you could train with any fictional character, who would you like to train with?
Wow, I really don't know. Fictional, because it's not really reality. What do you?
Well, I'm talking about, you know, someone like, you know, Mr. Miyagi, or I've had a Kung Fu Panda mentioned a few times.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah, you know, kind of, I would say Jackie Chan. You know, I think he, I don't know, I like the way Jackie Chan moves, as far as he uses his environment with everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to do the stunts he does, but but I think he can move really well. You know, he's definitely a good martial artist.
All right. Very nice. All right. So now we are going to move to our shameless self-promotion. So you can plug anything that you like, or if there's anything that you wanted to make sure that we get out that you haven't mentioned, now's your time to throw that out there, and then we'll close out for part one, and we'll work on scheduling part two.
So, so what do you mean by shameless promotions?
So you know, if you want to promote your school or website, or some of my previous guests have written books, or just anything that comes to your mind that you want to get out there for this episode, then
sure.
Yeah, run out there.
Yeah, I don't write books, but my school, you know, I welcome anybody to come in that wants to come in and train. American Family Kempo Karate. We're in Spring Valley, California, in actually an area called Casa Duro. It's close to La Mesa. And it's not a real big school, but yeah, we enjoy, you know, teaching anyone that wants to learn. You know, I have had students I've turned away that, you know, I didn't feel, you know, they wanted to even be there, that might be harmful to the school, I should say. You know, you have some students come in that just they don't really want to be there, but they come there anyhow. You know, it's like, why are you here? You know, go somewhere else, find out what fits you. You know, if anybody's interested in stand up, you know, self-defense, that's my goal. That's what I enjoy teaching. And I do private lessons also. And I do them online too. So, you know, I do like a group of lessons. I usually put a group of lessons for like $300 for 10 lessons. And we can do it online, or we can do it in person, you know, whatever works. Online, I always recommend that someone has somebody with them so they can work with them. But a beginner, intermediate, advanced, want to work on movement, whatever it happens to be. Like I said, I'm a real stickler for the basics and making sure that your movement's good and that your position's good and you understand the technique. Because if you don't understand the technique and how the body moves, you're not going to be able to do the technique properly. So like I say, we don't do as many techniques, but it's not like I give belts away either. It still takes somebody, you figure four forms, 46 techniques and the basics and the sets. On the average, it still takes somebody about 4 years to make black belt if they're putting quite a bit into it. But not the, it took me 7 years. Actually, I was ready at 6 years. I had my material, but Ed Parker passed away right before, and I don't know what happened, but I continued to teach, I continued to train, but I didn't test. And Darby asked me, you know, he's like, hey, you know, you need to test for your black. And I'm like, you know, I just, my heart wasn't into the testing part of it at that point. You know, it's funny because he had told me this because we had a conversation, and I said, well, Ed Parker's not alive anymore. And he said, well, Ed Parker's not your instructor anyways, which he wasn't. It was Darby. You know, Darby trained from Ed Parker, not me. So, you know, I'm like, oh, you're right. You know, I need to kind of open my eyes and kick my ass in gear and test for it.
Very nice. All right. Well, that is going to, we're going to close out for this part today. I thank you so much for taking the time to share your story, and yeah, there's always with every guest, there's always so much that I want to get into. And we'll definitely have you for part two, so we can get a little deeper dive into some of the things that you've brought up. But I just can't thank you again, and thank you enough, I should say. And thank you so much. And we'll close out. And
sounds
and,
good.
I can't wait to get this out for everyone here. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Big salute to you.
Thank you for listening to My Empty Hands. If you enjoyed the show, please share it with a friend. If you didn't enjoy it, please share it with an enemy. If you'd like to be a guest, or if you would like to recommend a guest for the show, please email me at podcast@talkingkenpo.com. Thank you.